Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry presents his last proposed budget before running for re-election, and it has a lot of new spending requests. Meanwhile, Anna Broche still isn't ruling out a run for mayor. And a federal judge says a transgender student can use the boys' bathroom at his St. Johns County High School. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. And this morning, for the full hour, we are breaking down a very busy news week around town with our Friday roundtable. You can get on the line right now and join us. The number is 549-2937. So pleased to welcome to Studio 5, David Bauerlein, reporter for the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
WJCT contributor Charles Griggs is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
And A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Good morning.
So good to have you here, guys. Lots to talk about this week. Everything from a court ruling in favor of a local transgender student to Anna Broche saying she's still thinking about tackling Mayor Lenny Curry in a race for mayor, and much more. Lots to talk about this morning, but first this hour, as he looks ahead to re-election, Jacksonville Mayor Lenny Curry is out with his new proposed budget for the city, calling for more than $1 billion in city spending. Now, the mayor says getting a pension reform plan approved a couple of years ago is why more funding is available for a range of city services and projects, and Curry says he'll do it without increasing property taxes. Take a listen.
We restored what they requested. So, look, it just demonstrates that Jacksonville's moving forward. It demonstrates what I said in there, that without pension reform, there would be no restoration of libraries. Without pension reform, there would be none of this heavy investment in CIP and investment in public safety.
Okay, so we begin the hour with a closer look at the mayor's spending priorities. We want your comments. It's 549-2937 to join us. David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. The mayor's calling for a big increase in public safety and police spending. There's more money for the Jacksonville Public Library system. There's a lot he wants to devote to shoring up infrastructure improvements all across town. Those are some of the items that really stand out in this budget.
Well, absolutely. It's a big spending plan, and if it all goes as he wants it to go in terms of the 4 or 5 years out, this is a taste of what's to come, that every year there would be this amount of spending to do a lot of projects that have been deferred for a long time over the years. You can argue about where the money should go, but there is a lot of spending that's going to be going to projects in neighborhoods and across the city.
And Charles Griggs, there's money for UF Health, the city's only safety net hospital, other really popular projects. This is an easy way, I guess, for the mayor to score political points with a range of constituencies, which, let's face it, this is what mayors do, as they head into re-election. What are your thoughts?
Someone called it Christmas in July.
Yeah, exactly.
They pretty much covered all of the areas. And all of the council districts, everybody's getting something, as they say. Everybody got something. And that's important because during the budget review process, what you're going to have is those representatives making sure that their areas are covered and that their priority projects have been dealt with, or at least so they can be scrutinized before the council. But one of the things that one of the criticisms I've heard is that the mayor, even though it covers a lot of areas in spending, it lacks a certain vision for the overall city. So there are no real bold projects that would stimulate economic growth, so to speak. So that was the only real criticism I've heard so far related to
money for that kind of project.
Yeah, other than projects that are on the table currently, like the Hart Bridge, tearing down the Hart ramp for future development over there. There isn't really anything out there, that sort of looks like something that's going to drive new business development for the entire community.
It's 549-2937. Give us a call this Friday. A.G. Gankarski, yeah, that's something the mayor wants to do, tear down those ramps that come off the Hart Bridge. By the way, there was a big traffic snarl on that bridge just this morning. People like those ramps because they can zip in and out of town pretty quickly on them, but the mayor wants them pulled down so that the area around the football stadium that Shad Khan is trying to develop can flourish.
Gosh, it's funny to think about how many times the rationale for tearing down those ramps has changed. First it was downtown development and revitalizing Bay Street. Then it was getting traffic to the port. They pushed that to the feds. The feds didn't buy it, so it's back to the original explanation. Developers apparently want those ramps down. And by developers, we can think of Shad Khan and people like that. Another thing we're spotlighting in this budget is a lot of the money is going to District 7, which is where the Hart Bridge ramps and the sports complex are, but also District 9, Garrett Dennis's district. $20.9 million is going to that district. A lot of it's going to McCoy's Creek, flooding remediation issues, $13 million there. It's an interesting calculus. I mean, not every district is getting paid off of this. The five-year plan, it's like $600 million. So you can kind of see the vision of what Curry has for the rest of his term and next term should he be reelected if the economy holds out and so on. A lot of ifs there. But, this is really something where, Curry came in knowing there was a big capital improvement backlog. He's betting his reelection on fulfilling part of that backlog.
Now, speaking of Garrett Dennis, one of the spending line items in Mayor Curry's budget is restoring some of the city's oldest African-American cemeteries, right? Garrett Dennis on the city council, a thorn in the mayor's side, tweeted the other day, "Thanks, Lenny Curry, for deciding to take care of an issue that has always been the responsibility of the city in order to pander for votes while living African Americans suffer every day from blight, failing or non-existent infrastructure, and lack of economic opportunity." Mayor Curry tweeted something out that might have been in response to that needling from Garrett Dennis. Same bleep, different place. Elected office is loaded with amateurs, folks with no ability to implement ideas. Many are full of empty rhetoric and a false sense of self. They survive on the bottom with cheap talk. We will retire some in the fights that matter when it matters. What is going on with Mayor Curry's Twitter account?
In the age of Twitter, this is one of the interesting things, is trying to figure out what things mean and what they're in response to. And it's a whole fun enterprise to do subtweets and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
I'm not sure in terms of Garrett Dennis's tweet. Is he saying don't do it and use the money for something else?
Is he saying it's pandering to African Americans to fix up the cemeteries when there are other needs that he might think are more urgent? I don't know.
I guess he can make that proposal and say let's use the money for something else. It's one of those many things that have been in the category of deferred maintenance, and there are a lot of things in deferred maintenance that could have been done instead of that. Whether it's pandering to votes, if there's a constituency out there for it that appreciates that, then that'll win them some votes. If there's not, then it won't matter.
Yeah, so in the old days during the budget process, what would happen was the council members would sort of confer with the administration and say, these are the types of projects I'd like to see in next year's budget. It doesn't sound like these are the types of projects that Councilman Dennis would prefer to see in his district for this particular piece, because while it's important, it sounds like he would rather see something more that would do more for people who are actually trying to make their way through everyday life, living, as he's said. And on the mayor's tweet, I've heard people say to me, I've never seen anything like that before in my life.
Yeah, so and by the really way, we had to reboot our phone system. give us a call. What do you think of the mayor's tweet and the budget? It's 549. Oh, we're still having problems with it, folks. We'll try to fix it. So hit us up on social media until we fix our phones. But go ahead, AG.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at that tweet that Curry put out Tuesday evening, he was babysitting his kids and then he stepped away to tweet that. That was a few hours after Garrett Dennis, during a council meeting, tweeted about, cemeteries not being a real present day issue for his constituents. So I think Curry remembered they really didn't like Garrett Dennis very much. They really doesn't like Anna Brochet very much. He really doesn't like a lot of people very much. And there's kind of a
Wait a minute. You're telling me that elected officials don't like each other?
Yeah, but I mean, really? Here's
oh
the thing
gosh.
Though. There's a protocol. And there are a lot of people right now who are saying that the mayor's office hasn't been so easy to deal with this year. It's not just Garrett Dennis and Anna Brochet who are having those issues. And it's going to be interesting to see how how Curry brings the team back in. There's obviously people on city council who are beholden to Curry. I mean, Council President Aaron Bowman, Council Vice President, and so on. But, you know, Curry is, you know, there's a lot of unforced errors. And, you know, Curry's basically throwing down the gauntlet, and throwing the gauntlet's great for a campaign. It's tough for a municipal government that is built on consensus.
He took a lot of heat from, he got ratioed. That's the Twitter saying for, you know, the response to his tweet was universally panned, I think. A lot of negative responses to using profanity and trash talking his political opponents on Twitter in this way. I don't think people that follow city politics saw that as mayoral, let's say.
You know, when I covered Donald Trump when he came to Jacksonville during his a stop at the Jacksonville Landing, I came back with the quotes and said, I just don't feel comfortable using some of these quotes because some of the profanity. A few years later, that's kind of like, oh, that's the new normal.
Yeah. Right. But it is Curry emulating that, that political style.
I think it's something that needs to be tamped down. I don't think public officials should be using that type of language in a public forum. We know what goes on probably behind closed doors, but there should be some decorum for public officials.
The relationships have been pretty coarse, but you know, I think most people believe that was a little beneath the mayor's standards for the way he would normally communicate, especially to, you know, through the public means. And it's understood that there is a difference in opinion on ideas, and that information probably needs to be dealt with on a higher level. If there are differing on how ideas are supposed to be, or ideas for how to move government, then that's how it should be shared, versus, you know, the types of things, the rhetoric we're seeing coming out in both cases, really, and sometimes both cases.
Okay, let me get to a few comments on social media. Speaking of the public safety budget that's out now that has to be approved by the fall, Nick writes, $30 million more for one of the worst-run police departments in the country. They are slowly closing in on $500 million, and that is insane. 33 cents of every dollar the city spends goes to JSO. He is pumping money into districts, but a huge amount is going into the 7th district, not for much needed sidewalks, failing roads, and other much needed projects, but to tear down the Hart Expressway. Well, just part of Shad Khan's way. And so getting criticism from that listener, here's one. If I were in Daniel writes, if I were in charge, I would tell the sheriff to put body cams on his officers and implement diversity training. Then next year, we'll study the efficiency of the officers and measure the relationship between JSO and the Black community. We'll talk in a minute about efforts JSO is making to reach out to one sector of the community. But, you know, there's cynicism about whether increased spending on public safety can improve public safety. The mayor ran on a public safety platform. Crime rates have gone up. He's got to run on that record. So it's not surprising, AG, that he would really beef up spending in this area. We do need a safer community. But what about the skepticism that's out there?
Well, a lot of this is baked into the cake. I mean, remember when the pension reform was bargained with the unions, there were raises built in. The JSO gets 20% raises over the course of 3 years. Corrections gets that. Fire gets that. City employees get a little bit less. But a lot of what you're seeing an uptick of salaries is something that's already collectively bargained. Some of the equipment stuff, like the true crime fighting lab or whatever the mayor calls it, you know, that's a big deal. But, you know, a lot of this is stuff that was basically already planned out. So, I mean, people are objecting to the spending increases, but, you know, really the objection probably should have been made a couple years ago during collective bargaining.
Yeah, I don't think people are objecting to the spending increases. I think they're probably more concerned about what's actually being spent on. And they want more accountability for those spending increases. The numbers, the proof is in the pudding. The numbers say that more police officers on the street has not equaled, a drop in crime. But so now what we want to know is how are you going to do it this time? We bought that the last time. And how are you going to do it this time? You're going to get more.
It's really unfortunate to see how this has gone over the years. David Bauerlein, going all the way back to the John Payton administration, when gun violence was spiking and kids were getting killed in their homes by stray bullets, like a girl named Rashana Davis. Payton came out with this Jacksonville Journey comprehensive anti-crime initiative, looking at the root causes of gun violence, family breakdown, poverty. There was a whole range of initiatives that were undertaken to get at the heart of this problem. Then Alvin Brown got elected and the program got largely defunded. Now we're into the Curry years and these efforts have not been completely set aside, but there isn't that white hot focus that we saw during the Peyton administration. We continue to have these problems. They seem to make a really genuine effort under Peyton to go at this with programs and initiatives that have been proven to work in other cities. And now they're just sort of off on the side. And we continue to see these issues.
Yeah, I think the crime is sort of a tale of two crime statistics. In terms of overall crime, which is everything from murder to burglaries to theft, the crime rate has been going down and continues to go down. The real nut that's been hard to crack has been the violent crime. And, it's not as bad now as it was at the worst of the Peyton administration. They had some real bloodshed.
It was terrible, yeah.
Yeah, and so, but it's not getting better. Now, part of the rationale behind having more police was that if you have more police out there on the beat, then they're able to spend more time actually interacting with people in neighborhoods, building better relationships between residents and police. Maybe that helps then in terms of increasing the trust factor so that, you know, when you're out there trying to solve crimes, there's more willingness to work with the police. Part of it is just the police presence. But obviously, if you have a violent crime, those are things that it's very difficult from a police presence to prevent those from happening. And that's where you get into some of these root issues and how to break this cycle of violence
right.
that really has been plaguing the city for years and years and years.
Yeah, I can speak to that in full disclosure as someone who served on the Jacksonville Journey Oversight Committee for 8 years. The initial first 4 years of it, when it was funding was at its highest, we saw a dramatic drop in violent crime over those first 4 years. And then, as you mentioned, Melissa, once funding started to get recycled
in other
areas.
And part of that was due to the economic crisis that we all experienced, but not, mm-hmm. yeah, that was yeah. part of what yeah. happened.
But,
yeah.
but it was probably mostly because of the comprehensive effort to look at crime from all sides as a root cause. And I think that some people are probably concerned that some of this is not fashioned in that way. It is sort of going directly to the law enforcement portion of it.
And I'm being told, by the way, that due to a reboot of our technology yesterday, we are not able to take phone calls this morning. Everybody out there, I'm so sorry to tell you that. So email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweet me at Melissa N. Jax or weigh in on our Facebook page. Here's a tweet from Jim. Councilman Garrett Dennis properly critiqued the mayor whose proposed budget seeks to take care of African Americans who are in the grave while doing very little for living constituents in African American communities. Agree or disagree? AG.
Well, that's something that Garrett Dennis is going to say. I mean, that's part of the political platform. And if you look at where things are in Northwest Jacksonville and, you know, the north side and various areas, it still looks like 1968 over there. The mayor's office of solutions, you know, getting drainage right, eventually doing septic tank phase out, that's not going to be finished remotely during his term. So, yeah, I mean, these are the recurrent questions. I mean, Jacksonville's been functioning on a cheap since consolidation, keeping millage rates low. There's no proposal to raise millage rates in this budget either. And there's not really the money to put into things other than, you know, paying back the donor class for what they want. You know, Peter Rummel's getting his property tax abeyance. Shotcom will get his deals and so on. But, you know, in terms of, you know, people in 7, 8, 9, and 10, they're not really getting their cut. And that's going to be the, you know, one of the things that Curry's eventual challenger, that's going to be the point they make on the trail.
Okay, let's get into that, because also making headlines this week, Jacksonville City Councilwoman Anna Broche told me she is still mulling a run for mayor herself. Take a listen.
It's a very big decision. It's not something to be taken lightly. And I tell people from time to time I'm a recovering overthinker. And so that's where we are.
Broche has to make a decision before the end of the year at the qualifying deadline. She did say she envisions a different sort of leadership than the one we've seen during Lenny Curry's first term. No love lost between these two. Can Anna Broche make it a race? Can she, if she gets in, can she attract the kind of donor and grassroots support she would need to make this a credible run against a sitting mayor with good approval numbers and a big campaign war chest. David.
Yeah, she could make a credible run for mayor. As AG's mentioned, the mayor has fostered some strong opposition in terms of his choices, in terms of how he's governed. So there's definitely a potential out there for somebody to run. You know, you're always going to start with any challenger with maybe 35% of the vote. It's getting to 50 that's a real challenge. And it's very difficult to run from a seat on city council for mayor. It's only happened once where Jake Godbole did it in modern times. And you know, there's a city
council. That probably talked behind closed doors the way Mayor Curry talks on Twitter, but I digress. go ahead.
Well, I was going to say there's sort of a city council president syndrome where people become city council president. They're kind of the center of the universe at City Hall for a year. And they may feel like because they're getting so much attention that they're that widely known outside in the community. And then you discover it after they're off the city council presidency that they're just one of 19, that they're really not as popular out there as they might think. So mm-hmm. I'm sure part of what you're looking at is polling. You know, how do I poll in terms of an election and whether I could actually, in the case of Anna Brochet, could actually translate being city council president and taking some opposition to Curry translates to a viable campaign.
Yeah, this is timing is everything. And as the council works through the budget process, a lot of the opportunities for whoever's going to run, whether it's Councilman Brochet or anyone else, are going to come clear because you'll get a feel for how the council is going to operate for the remaining of the year. You know, you'll know who mm-hmm. the real players are, who has the advantages, who's close to, who's more connected to the mayor's office and so forth. And so those opportunities will come clear. And for any candidate, whether it's Councilman Brochet or not, they have to line up support. And that support happens before they make a decision to run. And if that support going to be enough to get that help that person uphill, do this uphill climb, then you know, I think that's when she will decide to get in.
Yeah, I mean, Brochet either way is running against the mayor's office. If she runs for anything, she runs for re-election, she's going to run against a candidate picked by City Hall. She runs against the mayor, she's going to deal with that directly. She's going to get the oppo. They're going to dig really deep into her past, finding everything they possibly can. So her supporters need to be on board through the inevitable, you know, tsunami.
It's going to get ugly, in other words.
It's going to get really bad. And this is the thing. If Anna Brochet wants in, she needs to stop being a classical overthinker and actually, you know, take the plunge and be willing to take the slings and arrows, because if they can get them out of the way early, they're not going to hit at the end of the campaign in the same way. You know, that's kind of the thing. You know, that's kind of an advantage of getting in a little bit early, is you'll get your opponent to exhaust their oppo. To try to discredit you initially. So, you know, that's one strategy. But, you know, every month that Anna Brochet wastes, Lenny Curry raises $250,000 more. And no matter what people might say privately about his leadership style, you know, they're still giving him that money. And so that's kind of the thing. It's like, does Anna Brochet or Garrett Dennis or anybody else have the stomach to deal with that machine?
Here's a comment on Facebook from Rhoda. Lenny Curry's budget is wasteful spending if he appropriates $30 million to police who racially profile and harass citizens on the north and east sides. Invest in job training, vocational schools, citations instead of arrest by JSO. They actually have increased civil citations, but that's somewhat of a related issue, mainly through the prosecutor's office. Okay, she goes on to say, the only reason JSO is adding a liaison to the sheriff's office is because activists pushed back. I won't support Anna Brochet, though, because she's proven when it comes to tough issues, she'll cave. Mm-hmm. That may be a reference to Brochet saying we need to look at removing Confederate monuments and then backing off that when it was obvious there wasn't the political will to do that, maybe.
That could be a reference to that.
I don't know. But you know what? Since we can't take phone calls today, we're going to take a quick break here on the show. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. We're going to continue in a moment. We want you to email us with your thoughts at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Weigh in on our First Coast Connect Facebook page or tweet me at Melissa in Jax. We will be right back. Keep listening.
appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this recipe for...
sweet and sour chicken rice bowl.
We always have a great time, so will you on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Sundays at 5 on 89.9 WJCT.
England's big northern cities are one of a kind.
If you come from Liverpool, you're called a Liverpudlian and also a Scouser.
Hike the Lake District hills that inspired Wordsworth.
They're not a huge, high mountain range. I find them a very human scale.
And learn what's behind the timeless beauty of the Cotswolds.
The whole of the British Empire was built on the backs of sheep.
On an all-England edition of Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday morning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Unlock your newest member benefit. Over 1,000 episodes of your favorite PBS shows. American Masters. Antiques Roadshow. Nature. Nova. Masterpiece. Watch the best of PBS anytime, anywhere. Become a member. Sign in and start streaming today.
WJCT.org/passport.
And welcome back. We're continuing our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week with A.G. Gankarski, David Bauerlein, and Charles Griggs. We can't take your calls today unless a miracle happens in the next few minutes. Just one of those technical things. But we're getting your tweets, emails, and Facebook comments. Here's one from Jimmy. If your panel could put away their smelling salts, they might well remember that elected leaders are people. Sometimes they use salty language, and there's no shame in acknowledging that. Listen to Nixon or LBJ on tape.
He's comparing the mayor to the Nixon tapes.
Well, also LBJ points out. So basically saying if the mayor wants to trash talk on Twitter, is that really the biggest deal in the world? That's something we were talking about a few minutes ago.
I think, it's the biggest deal in the world, but I think it's something there should be lines that shouldn't be crossed. I mean, newsrooms have a lot of salty language, but we don't put it in our news stories. And I'm sure behind closed doors, like LBJ references, elected officials let loose colorful language, but... in the tweet we're talking about, I mean, instead of saying same blank, why don't you just say same thing here? You know, what is the point in doing this sort of, putting an obscenity into a tweet?
Because he wanted to highlight it clearly. He wanted that attention. He wanted that discussion. He wanted to, bring the conflict to the fore. I do think it's questionable when an advocate for the mayor compares it to the Nixon tapes. I mean, the Nixon tapes, brought down the Nixon administration or Lyndon Baines Johnson. Lyndon Baines Johnson had all kinds of interesting human resource issues, including, making people
He would go to the bathroom in front of people.
Yes, he would. He'd go to the bathroom in front of
aides.
My
goodness.
And congresspeople. He would make people swim naked with them. Lyndon Johnson has some
issues.
This
was not the Me Too era, let's just say.
Right. These are not models for, governors, even in the strong mayor, continuum. But that said, I mean, Mayor Curry was obviously messaging, telling his critics, put up or shut up. Put up yet.
Some people just have a hard time seeing a guy who was at the podium on Monday giving his budget presentation, having that type of tweet come out again. From my perspective, it just seems like it was just a little beneath what he's been presenting in the public space. If that's the direction he wants to go in the future to make a point, then that's his right.
Right. And calling somebody an amateur, fine. Call somebody an amateur. Yeah. And that would have gotten a lot of people's attention. I just think it's over the top.
Well, he's right. The politicians in this town are not professional politicians by and large. These operations, are second rate. They're amateurish. I mean, Lenny Curry's exactly right in that most of the politicians in this town couldn't make it in bigger markets. He has a road tested appeal to Republicans, the center right kind of thing. And, I think he doesn't really get credit for that. And, part of his tweet was saying that.
All right. Also making news this week, we want to talk about another big story that caught our eye. This week, a federal judge said a St. Johns County high school student who is transgender can use the boys' bathroom during his final year in school. U.S. District Judge Timothy Corrigan wrote in his ruling that federal courts must uphold the Constitution, which is why courts around the country have recognized the right of transgender students to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity. Now, this ruling by Corrigan just yesterday means that Nice High School senior Drew Adams, who is 18, can begin using the boys' bathroom at his school when classes resume there August 10th. He had sued because the school had been forcing him to use gender-neutral bathrooms, citing a district policy. Adams says he's excited to be a normal kid, take college-level courses. He also will receive a National Spirit of Matthew Award for the named after the late Matthew Shepard, a Wyoming kid who was murdered for being gay. And so email us, firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. Facebook, we welcome your comments there. A major ruling coming out from Judge Corrigan on this issue, and a precedent-setting one, I would guess, as well. David and Charles and AG?
Yeah, I would think so, too. The part of Corrigan's ruling that stands out to me, this is quoting from him, saying that Adams, quote, poses no threat to the privacy or safety of his fellow students. Rather, Drew Adams is just like every other student at Nice High School, a teenager coming of age in a complicated, uncertain, and changing world. So, I mean, obviously, if a judge looks at it and says, oh, it does pose a threat to the privacy or safety, then a ruling would be different. And that has been the big objection to some of these bathroom policies. So I do think it's something that obviously it's just a district court ruling, but it does set a standard. And if it's it could be a sign of how things are done throughout the court system in these particular cases.
The school principal had testified that she did not consider Drew to be a boy. He testified at his 3-day trial in December, I am a boy, and I know that with every fiber of my being. So the judge ruling in this young man's favor is saying the school has to accommodate this and not fight it any longer.
Yeah, it seems like the simple part about this was in every other space Adam was able to use the men's bathroom, except this school. So that made it easier for Judge Corrigan to arrive where he arrived with the decision, because it seemed like this was the only place that he was being denied access to the boys' bathroom.
What's interesting, too, as the Times Union and others have reported, is that by and large, the student body at the school, AG, saw it as a non-issue. It was more the parents and the educators that had a problem with it, showing the generational split on these types of issues.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something where people who've grown up with Mr. Adams, have come to terms with the changes he's chosen to make to get toward his gender identity. But administrators in a public school, parents, that's a different matter. And we saw it here at the Human Rights Ordinance debate, where we had all these worries about, transgenders in bathrooms and all of the things that were supposed to, theoretically happen if the Human Rights Ordinance expansion had passed. It didn't happen that way. I mean, this becomes a wedge issue that's designed to whip up the base on the right. It's dishonest. I think that's what Corrigan's ruling got to the heart of, the fact that, Mr. Adams is a man. He should be able to use the men's bathroom. And, that's it. I mean, I think appeal courts are going to basically back up that ruling.
Robert emails the show, I'm a progressive person, but does this mean that someone simply has to dress in the other sex's clothing to use the other gender bathroom? That's a question that came up a lot, as you said, during the debate over Jacksonville's passage of the Human Rights Ordinance.
Well, it doesn't. But, I have some sympathy, too, for the school administrators. I mean, they have to a very difficult decision-making process in terms of when and where do they draw that line. You could also say that the school administrators are trying to make decisions in complicated, uncertain, and changing world in terms of how to apply different policies. To my mind, they made a good faith effort to have the gender neutral. That's what you have courts for, to look at these things and determine what is the way to apply the law to this situation.
Yeah, I think that one of the deciding pieces here, at least one from Adam's perspective, would be, or someone from transgender perspective, is that they have no will to want to enter a restroom that they don't identify with. So, you know, they're making a decision based upon their own transgender identity, and they're not imposing that on anyone else. So that is where the, you know, that there's no evidence that there's a safety issue here, because people aren't going to want to go where they don't want to go.
Okay. In a related story, we want to talk about this for a minute too. We've been talking about public safety, the police, more money for more officers on the streets. At the same time this week, we learned that Jacksonville Sheriff's Office says it's going to work to improve relationships with the local LGBT community. After the shootings of four transgender women in the city this year, JSO is appointing a liaison to that community and setting up more officer training around transgender issues. Let us know your thoughts about this at First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. Tweets to at Melissa in Jax. This change seems to happen after members of that community really mobilized and criticized JSO for identifying the victims as men and using their given names instead of their chosen names. Three of these people that were shot died. And so activists have been holding press conferences, pressuring city council, pushing for this liaison. There's a big meeting coming up August 2nd, a Sheriff's Watch community forum to discuss these issues. This will be at the FSCJ downtown campus auditorium at 7 p.m. August 2nd. So we see JSO responding to this constituency. What are your thoughts, guys?
You know, that's the thing. It's like they're having to respond because, you know, these killings are taking the attention of the world. And the idea of a liaison is something that will have to be eventually formalized. I mean, you know, Jacksonville is very conscious of its Human Rights Campaign Municipal Quality Index score. That was around 20 out of 100, like as late as 2014, 2015. Now it's in the 80s. And part of that is because they're codifying outreach to these communities. You know, that being said, JSO, much as it is done throughout the Mike Williams era, is trying to do this without publicity, basically. You know, the undercover cop is a liaison to the community. And that raises questions of public accountability. It's a functional liaison, but is it a public liaison in a real sense? You know, what's going to have to happen is that they're going to have to formalize these relationships. It's what's happening in other big cities, and Jacksonville's going to have to follow suit.
Yeah, I attended an outreach meeting a couple of weeks ago JSO had representation and some members from the LGBT community where they are talking about the specific liaison subject. And what the perception is that JSO only practices outreach on their terms. They need to look and utilize the resources of the community better to help them develop what these liaisons should look like and what these communities should, and be better informed on how to deal with, you know, not only the LGBT community, but other areas of the community as well. Mm-hmm. So that is more accountability to what we talked about earlier, and also being able to be more informed about some of the cases that are out there that they can help and build better relationships with the community.
JSO has what they call SHADCO, community relations, little nodes all over the city. Are those not adequate in the context that we're looking at? Apparently not.
Yeah, obviously not. I mean, I think it's a case then to have more of a tailored message and information sharing. And to Charles's point, I mean, obviously, yes, a lot of policing requires trust, community conversation both ways. So to the extent that this can help, it definitely can help JSO as well in terms of doing what it needs to do effectively.
Sure. Now, also this week, we want to talk about state politics for a minute. So many issues roiling the state, and they're all factoring into the governor's race. As just one example, some of the student activists from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, the March for Our Lives movement, they will be at the Jacksonville Landing today as part of a party and voter registration drive, trying to get more young people involved in politics. Apparently, voter registration in Florida among those aged 18 to 29 is up some 40% since that mass shooting in South Florida at that high school in Parkland. At the same time, we've got a new poll out that's good news for Republican Ron DeSantis and Democrat Gwen Graham in the race to be Florida's next governor. The primary is just a month away, and a new poll shows Graham and DeSantis as the front runners in the race to replace Governor Rick Scott, leading their gubernatorial primaries. This is going to be, if those two are the nominees, you're looking at the Me Too candidate versus the Donald Trump candidate. You couldn't ask for a starker contrast in the governor's race if that's who we have to choose from, guys. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, it does set up, when you put it that way, really well for Gwen Graham. You know, however, you know, I want to go back 8 years, Rick Scott and Alex Sink. You know, that's kind of what this dynamic reminds me of in certain ways. I mean, DeSantis is going to have access to money from across the country, basically. You know, Gwen Graham, you know, she's the central casting Democratic establishment candidate. She's run a workmanlike campaign. She's got a lot of establishment support. I don't know if the Gwen Graham model is going to translate past the Democratic base, though. I think DeSantis is very comfortable with winning by 1 or 2 points. You know, even though DeSantis is prone to verbal gaffes, kind of like his gaffe last week with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, where he referred to her as this girl or whatever she is, the fact is that DeSantis has been underestimated throughout this campaign. It looks like he's about to capsize Adam Putnam, and I wouldn't underestimate him going to the governor's race either.
Yeah, I agree with AG on this. Gwen Graham is a great candidate. But it's going to take more than just, you know, someone out of, you know, central casting for Democrats to win. They have to be someone who can bring energy to the party and bring energy to the state. If they don't, then the Republican nominee, especially in a situation like someone like DeSantis, who is, you know, supported by President Trump, is going to, you know, kind of walk away with this thing. They always look at these little lost opportunities for winning these elections, and the party, speaking of Democrats now, these little lost opportunities for winning these elections, and after the fact, that should be addressed now. If you're Gwen Graham or one of the leading Democratic candidates, you have to be looking at where these votes are, where these opportunities are that Republicans are not paying attention to.
I think the wild card that we need to mention quickly, too, is the Democratic base is really motivated to vote this fall. Will the Republican base be as motivated? Which side is going to turn their people out? That's what it will come down to.
Well, in terms of Trump, he's a huge factor in giving DeSantis a big edge in getting the Republican Party nomination. How will that affect Democratic turnout if he's running side by side with Donald Trump in November? Independents, how are they going to break as a result of that? The case of Alex Sink versus Rick Scott, I think that's an interesting parallel that AG brings up. Rick Scott is an interesting person in that he often was under 50% in approval ratings, and yet he won election twice. It's a very weird dynamic. So it doesn't necessarily...
It's Florida. Everything's a weird dynamic.
Everything's weird.
Speaking of which, we're going to talk about that in a moment here on the show. Keep listening.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Malignant mesothelioma. Asbestos dust causes this cancer. Learn more from board-certified civil trial specialist Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
89.9 WJCT thanks the following business partners for their generous support. Atlantic Beach Experimental Theater. Anthony's Gourmet Catering. Roland Sound. For information, contact Anna Marie Stanford at 358-6390.
President Trump is celebrating what he says are victories on trade.
We have the worst trade deals ever made in history, but now they're becoming good again.
I'm Audie Cornish. Some of the issues he's resolving were created by his own administration. More on the week in politics this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Young man, who are you? What's your name?
Henry Deaver.
That's not Henry Deaver.
Castle Rock is the new Hulu horror series based on Stephen King's characters and themes, produced by King and set in a fictional Maine town. On the next Fresh Air, we feature excerpts from our interviews with Stephen King. Join us.
Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Trade war? What trade war? The U.S. and the EU reach a deal to lower tariffs and resolve their differences. Plus, President Trump puts his invitation to Vladimir Putin on hold, and a cricket champion claims victory as Pakistan's new prime minister. The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, we talked about a lot of stories this week, but there may have been a few that escaped our attention. Time for a new feature on the show. It's our lightning round as our panel educates us on what we missed. A.G. Gankarski.
Well, there's a story percolating in St. Augustine this week. The editor of a website, Historic City News, sent a racist email full of coded language to somebody who asked to be taken off of an email list for a candidate he was supporting. This editor, he is a major political consultant for the St. Augustine mayor, Nancy Shaver. You know, she's in a re-election fight. You know, so is the commissioner that he was advocating for. This story has blown up on FloridaPolitics.com. It was our biggest story yesterday because it represented the intersection of a lot of issues. I mean, St. Augustine with its, you know, complicated racial history, a mayor who seemingly is not conscious of what her lead consultant is doing. You know, this could really affect that election down there. That's an August primary. It's competitive, and this is one to watch.
One to watch. David.
And my Times Union colleague, Chris Hong, wrote a story this week about Terrence Freeman, who is controversial already in terms of how he was appointed to a district council seat, was not actually employed at the time of his appointment, although he had written in his application for the position he did have a job and actually had applied for unemployment benefits around that time. It's yet another sort of shoe that's dropping in terms of the whole appointment process, adds some of the controversy about it, and it makes it a little more difficult for Terrence Freeman to get going in that position.
In that position. Charles.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the one we didn't talk about, which is the one about the Duval County Public Schools regarding the budget cuts that the board staved off, cuts to arts, music, and so forth, and they did that by sort of readjusting the payback for their reserve that allowed them to keep those positions and those programs in place.
Yeah, good to see that.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
And finally this hour, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida, the transportation edition. And only in Florida does a man steal a forklift. Why would you do that? And lead police on a multi-county chase. This happened Sunday in Clay County, where deputies say 22-year-old Nicholas Powell of Jacksonville stole a forklift from Sunbelt Rentals in Orange Park.
Oh, no.
He decided to drive it down Blanding Boulevard, which is nice, you know. Hey, why not?
Yeah, any time of day.
Any time of day, you know, like they need any more traffic. The police pulled him over, but he kept driving right into Jacksonville. They finally got him in the grass field of a gas station on 103rd Street. No word on how they got the forklift back to Sunbelt Rentals.
Why would it take them 5 miles to apprehend this guy? He's on a forklift. I mean, couldn't they shoot out the tires or barricade him or something?
Can you imagine the spectacle of this?
You have to wonder what Daryl Daniels is doing over there in Clay County. They let this guy escape on a forklift.
And only in Florida does the phrase, let's call an Uber, mean big bucks for the state's economy. A new study from the Economic Development Research Group finds that the top ride-sharing app supports $1 billion of Florida's gross domestic product. Take-home payouts for Uber partners hit a whopping $870 million last year in Florida. Of course, most of those drivers are part-time and spend less than 20 hours a week ferrying people around behind the wheel in order to earn extra money. The state legislature relaxed laws on ride-sharing last year, which is being credited for the Uber boost.
That is a tough way to make a living.
It is a tough way to make a living. So on the one end, they're touting this pumping in of cash, but on the other end, it speaks to the gig economy, where people are having to do this just to get by.
And what is it doing to the taxi cab industry?
It's not helping.
Yeah, I mean, they're not getting medallion fees anymore in the city. And there's been a moratorium for about a year because of this.
Yeah.
But we're all going to still use Uber from time to time, right? Yeah. Anyway, thanks, David Barreline, Charles Griggs, and A.G. Gankarski. Guys, thanks for spending the whole hour here, and have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. If you missed anything from this morning's show, just catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. And don't forget to join us at 1 this afternoon for the Florida Roundup, our live call-in program looking at the biggest stories from around the state. Everything from a controversial Stand Your Ground case to a judge's ruling throwing out a ban on early voting on Florida's college campuses. That and more is coming up at 1. Meanwhile, 1A is up next with the Friday News Roundup. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.